You're listening to the Faith 2020 podcast, helping you see 2020 clearly through the lens of faith. Now here's your host, Michael Ware.
This is the Faith 2020 podcast. I'm your host, Michael Ware, and this episode is different. We have a crossover episode featuring a conversation I had with someone I've admired for a very long time. So grateful to have this conversation, excited to bring it to you. I had the opportunity to talk with Miroslav Volf. Miroslav Volf is the Henry B. Wright Professor of Theology at Yale Divinity School. He's the founder and director of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. He was educated in his native Croatia, a beautiful country, very close to Italy, by the way. He was educated in his native Croatia, the United States, and Germany, earning doctoral and postdoc degrees with highest honors from the University of Tübingen, Germany. I got to ask my wife how to pronounce that. He has written or edited more than 20 books, over 100 scholarly articles, and his work has been featured in the Washington Post, Christianity Today, Christian Century, Sojourners, and several other outlets, including NPR's Speaking of Faith, which is now on Being with Krista Tippett, one of the most insightful, rich interview sort of format shows that we've had in a long time, and Public Television's Religion and Ethics News Weekly. Some of his most significant books include Exclusion and Embrace, A Theological Exploration of Identity, Otherness, and Reconciliation, A Free of Charge, Giving and Forgiving in a Culture Stripped of Grace, Allah, A Christian Response, A Public Faith, How Followers of Christ Should Serve the Common Good, Flourishing, Why We Need Religion in a Globalized World, and For the Life of the World, Theology That Makes a Difference, his most recent book that he co-authored with Matthew Crossman. I hope you enjoy this conversation. It's intended to be, at least I intended it, to be a bit of a break from in the weeds sort of, horse race kind of talk, and thought, let's pull out a bit. This election is in less than 3 weeks. We'll be doing at least a couple more episodes before the election. And don't worry, we'll get into it. You'll be prepared for election night. But in order to be prepared, you don't just need to know who's up and down in the polls and who's spending money where and that kind of thing. These are conversations that I think are really important. So here's my conversation with Miroslav Volf. I'm so excited to be talking with someone I've admired for a long time, and it's great to be in conversation, especially in this moment in the life of the church and the life of the nation. Miroslav, is it okay if I call you by your first name?
Absolutely, the only possible thing you can do, and you should know, admiration is mutual.
Oh, I appreciate that. It's so good to be with you. Your work has been an inspiration to me in a number of ways. I wrote a book called Reclaiming Hope, and you've written on hope a great deal, and hopefully we'll get to that in our conversation. But you edited a volume called The Future of Hope, and I don't think I've had the opportunity to tell you that was one of the most influential, volumes as I was trying to work through hope and its implications for public. And so I just want to thank you for all that you've contributed to the public square and to my life personally. So thank you. Would love to just ask you how you found yourself in this work. We are, for a lot of reasons, culturally, socially, theologically, particularly evangelicalism in this country, can tend to be individualistic, personal, and yet you're someone who's brought evangelical thinking, Christian thinking into public and applying it to public questions. Where does that come from for you? Why do you think that you've been drawn to that work?
Well, that's very interesting what you describe, because my father was a Pentecostal minister, my grandfather was a Baptist minister and lived in former Yugoslavia, and it was very much a pietistic kind of environment. And this is not to disparage it in any ways, because I was nurtured in a very important ways in it. But certainly, we did not think in terms of politics and political engagement, except that our entire life was lived under the cloud of oppressive cloud of a state, which we could influence in absolutely no way. So that you had this the situation of personal piety under conditions of political impotence. And there's always something obviously grating about that. And then I had the fortune, of course, to study with Jürgen Moltmann. And Jürgen Moltmann is describes himself as a political theologian. By the way, he moved from very personalist to much more political way of thinking under influence of his wife. And then for myself, I have I've done doctoral dissertation that deals with economics and with political issues as well. But I have in most recent years then discovered how I want to marry the two, kind of the pietism and the kind of political engagement. And I found that even the most, I can put it this way, even the most intimate of my desires, I have discovered have a political dimension. They have political horizon. They have economic horizon. Indeed, entire globalization processes have shaped and can refract themselves in my very desire. And so between my own steerings of my heart, as well as the largest global environment one can imagine, is where our lives is being lived. And I think we've got to work on the inside of the cup, but we've got to also work on the systems in which this cup, so to speak, sits.
Yes, absolutely. My story is almost pretty reverse of yours. I was
that's interesting.
I was from Buffalo, New York, so the Rust Belt, and I was raised in a Catholic family, but religion wasn't too important to me growing up. I was interested in civics, though, and politics, and I became a Christian after reading Romans when I was about 15.
Wow, that's great. So you got to tell me a little bit of that story. What happened with Romans? Because I love Apostle Paul. He's my favorite theologian.
So, you know, obviously it's a longer, a bit of a longer story. You know, my sister became a Christian a few years before I did. And so she had been working on me. There's a through line of, you know, I probably first heard the gospel through the Black church and Black music because the radio stations I'd listen to, they'd play R&B music, which I loved as a child. But then if you were listening on Sunday, it became a gospel station. And so I'd be hearing gospel music and preachers as I waited for, you know, R&B music to come on. When I was about 15, my sister dragged me to her youth group, and I didn't like it, but that's a whole other story. But on my way out of the youth group, a volunteer was just handing out tracts of Romans, no commentary, no nothing, just Paul's letter.
Wow.
And I took it home and read it again. And, you know, I had been, you know, a pretty conventional sort of intellectual. I had a pretty like pseudo intellectual sort of, oh, religion is a crutch. You know, there's no there. You can't read Romans. You could reject Paul's argument. You could reject what Paul lays out in Romans, but you can't read Romans and continue to say that there's no there in the Christian faith. You know, you can't read through Romans and not have to at least, look Jesus in the eye and either tell him yes or no. And that's the experience that I had. I read Romans and got a sense of the full sweep of what God has done and is doing in the world. And it captured me. And so at that point I thought, well, everything needs to change. I probably need to go to seminary, become a pastor. You know, you just want to do the most Christian thing possible. And thankfully, I had a pastor in my life who said, you know, Michael, if you look around, you know, turns out not every Christian is a pastor. and I thought that was a good observation. And so, Miroslav, the vocational question that has guided my life from that time has been, you know, what does it mean to be faithful in public things? That question, that vocational drive put me in DC in school and sent me on a trajectory where, you know, I worked in politics and to some extent, you know, continue to work at the intersection of politics and culture and helping Christians navigate cultural and political landscape that is very complex, as we'll, I'm sure, talk about. But so that's, you know, it, for me, it was kind of politics first. And then I became a Christian and thought, well, probably needs to change. But then I looked and saw, look, really looks like Jesus is claiming lordship over all things.
And if you go back to Paul, read through certain eyes, you discover him. Wow, there's a kind of this whole political dimension of his thought that is amazingly important.
Absolutely. So that's a bit of what's brought us, you know, both to this point in our lives. I think, Miroslav, you've helped so many Christians and the broader public think through the implications of their faith for public life. The dialogue around this question is changing, especially over the last few years. But I know it's still a pressing question for many. Like, why should Christians why should they care about politics? What is there anything in the Christian faith that would motivate one to politics? Or is it just a minefield that sort of Christians should try to avoid at all costs? How have you thought about that question?
Well, it seemed to me that a little bit prior question to that would be the question, are there public goods for which Christians should be concerned? Is Christian faith something that has to be thought as having a political dimension? And, you know, my mind immediately goes, and has gone for some time, to the teaching of Jesus, at the center of which was the kingdom of God. Well, now, if kingdom is anything, it is a political concept. Yeah. So that the whole idea of Messiah, of the reign of God as a king, already is a political concept, and I think behind that is a sense that the salvation is not a salvation of individual soul, although that it is as well, but rather something happens in the world. In the book of Revelation, you have a new Jerusalem, a city, coming down from heaven and becomes this public reality, rather than each individual soul beholding the beauty of God and maybe lined up like chairs of people watching a beautiful sunset. And that's the extent to which there's something common, commonly human about it. So I take it Christian faith to be both concerned with very materiality of our world, and also as being something that that has inherently political dimension. I would even say, put it this way, maybe that's some people will think of it as heretical, but I can't quite come into fullness of being who truly I am and God intends me to be without the entirety of the world relations being what they're supposed to be. That's why Hebrew prophets speak about the peace, which is shalom of the whole realm, that is the salvation. And individual and the whole community and the entire earth finds their salvation together.
That tension is sort of, as you're indicating, part of, you know, what drives us to politics. Politics is a realm that is addressing these questions. And you know, it's interesting. You brought up sort of your background in Yugoslavia, and I've always had the caveat when I make the case for Christian political involvement, I'm speaking specifically in an American context and specifically in a context of sort of a representative form of government, because I'm frankly not sure that there is a sort of transcendent call for Christians to be invested in politics, no matter what the system of government, no matter the time or the place. And so it's interesting you raise that. But in this country, we all hold a political office of being citizens, and we all have a responsibility that is sort of inherent to where God has placed us, that we that isn't really a choice of whether we have it or not, but it's really about how we steward that influence, how we steward that responsibility. I find myself drawn to politics because of that tension of knowing that things are not as God will have them, that there's injustice that is not in line with God's will, and that politics is not the only sort of forum for addressing those things, but it certainly is one of them. And politics is something that not only sort of seeks to address injustice, but can also, as you've alluded to in the history of your life and your family's life, politics can perpetuate injustice in really profound ways. I find that many people don't think about politics that way. And it's understandable because, frankly, the practice of politics, those who are elected officials, the way that politics is sort of discussed in media doesn't seem to focus on these discrete but important ends of politics, but to a whole other set of sort of cultural and personal functions that, in my view, sort of detract from, again, the discrete but important sort of purpose of politics. How do you sort of navigate through these sort of various meanings and sort of uses for, you know, the realm of politics?
Well, so it seems to me that politics is one of the means, and that's what I've heard you say right now. Mm-hmm. If I heard you rightly, that politics is one of the ways and means by which we can discharge our public responsibility.
Yes,
it's not the only one, but certainly very, very important one, because it has a significant impact in not simply on our life, but of life of all of our neighbors for whom we should care. And so my sense has always been, and maybe that partly describes both my passion for it and a bit of a homelessness in it, because my sense was, I've got to keep the means and the ends together. That is to say, I want to achieve certain goods that are defined by the Christian faith, but I also have to achieve those goods with means that are in sync with the Christian faith. And at least some circles that I observe, which somehow think and at least act as if means are outside the scope of our responsibility, that is to say, or outside the scope of the content of the Christian faith. I find the means extremely important, and that's what then shapes whether and in what way I might be involved in politics, in addition, of course, to the particular calling that I have. But all of this is just to say, we should think about ends which we need to achieve, and we should think about what are the best means to achieve them as well.
Yeah. One sort of way that I've tried to describe how many American Christians in particular think about politics is you get the sense sometimes, by the way people talk about it, as if politics is sort of the one area of life that is sort of cordoned off from God. God can be trusted when it comes to your finances, your personal relationships, but when it comes to politics, oh gosh, that's so dark, that's so complicated. There's so much going on there. Does he really have anything trustworthy to offer there? There are all kinds of prudential, sort of practical ideas I have about sort of what kind of policies I think Christians should support, sort of what Christian priorities should be. But really quickly, when you sort of investigate this kind of intersection between faith and politics, really quickly it becomes a discipleship issue. Really quickly it becomes like a spiritual formation issue. And what I mean by that is, if you were a pastor and you were speaking with someone who was coming to you for spiritual guidance, and there was any area of their life in which they said, you know, I think Jesus would have me act this way, but I don't think that's the safe or appropriate way to go, you'd immediately identify that as a real problem, as a problem of the integrity of the person as a follower of Jesus. And those kinds of questions creep into our politics all the time. Now, just to be clear, I'm not suggesting there's sort of, a one-to-one sort of application. I think the way that we apply our faith to politics is complex and needs to be sensitive to, again, time and place and the circumstances we find ourselves in. But I do think there's this sort of post-World War II notion that religious moral knowledge just cannot be trusted when it comes to public things. And that's infected not just our broader culture, but Christians themselves, who Dallas Willard calls this the disappearance of moral knowledge. And I think that affects quite a bit of Christian political thinking. So that you end up in an environment where you have broad swaths of Christians who will sort of consciously accept things in politics that they would not accept in any other area of life, condone things in politics that they would not condone in any other area of life. Does that sort of match up with some of your reading for how Christians in this country are thinking about politics and approaching political engagement?
Yeah, what was interesting to me in terms of how you diagnose this and described it is a kind of a de facto secularization of the public space in the course of modernity kind of gets to be internalized by Christians, so that they intentionally then leave their faith outside of their either workplace or their political engagement and consider these two realms, the private realm and the public realm, as kind of two separate realms. I obey the inner logic of political engagement when I'm in politics. I obey the inner logic of economic engagement when I'm in the workplace, and then I have my family and kind of private life. Mm-hmm. That seems to me quite right that there is and you see here again the kind of the influence of outside on how Christians perceive their own responsibility. What struck me also with some of this, especially with those who maybe with slightly different sense think, oh, the politics is it's too contested, it's too dirty. You've got to make compromises and so forth. So the politics end up being this sinful world. And presumption is that the interior life and family life is then somehow pure and can be pure and is pure. Mm. Whereas if you observe, it's very hard to say whether more violence happens in the living rooms or on battlefields. Mm. Or in the public other public domains.
Yeah.
Private domains can be extremely violent, which is to say sinful, not to speak all other forms of sins. And so I come more to this from a Luther's side, which deems every person always already as sinner and justified, so that in personal life, there's not this purity sphere that then can be preserved there, and then we can allow ourselves to let go in the public domains. So I think if we discover also that sin runs through the middle of our hearts, it'll be easier to kind of live in a situation, an ambiguous situation outside in the political realm as well, while we resist that trend that you described of almost like self-secularization in public sphere.
I think you're right about this related stream of Christians just viewing politics as dirty and an area rife with opportunities to compromise one's faith. And in a way, that's right. I mean, I can just, there are all kinds of temptations in political life as a citizen, certainly working in politics. I think I was glad that you brought in the notion of vocation and work, because when people sort of raise with me the compromises and tensions in politics, I will often ask them what they do for work. And yeah. One time I was speaking in New York, and very similar, someone came up to me, said, you know, gosh, it seems like you held it together, but how did you do it being a Christian in government? And I asked what they did for a living, and they said, oh, I'm on Wall Street. And I thought, well, that's a real conversation we could have. How do you do what you do and maintain faithfulness?
They seem to conveniently forget that greed is idolatry in the New Testament.
That's right. And so I'm sure that person faces all kinds of temptations that are both unique and universal at the same time. But yeah. You know, we're in the middle of a presidential election right now. And so this is something that comes up in the context of voting. In my experience, this idea that if you vote for a candidate, you're kind of on the hook for everything they are and everything they stand for and everything that they do in the future, sort of whether you know it or not. And then party identification, sort of if you are registered as a member of a party, that they that party sort of owns your identity, and you have to answer both to the public and the suggestion is, you know, at the pearly gates, so to speak, you will have to answer for your party registration. I don't mean to ask a rhetorical question here, but is that right at all? And if so, in your point of view, assess how Christians ought to be thinking about things like voting and party identification.
Yeah, that's interesting. I tend to distinguish between kind of normal times and the times that we live in now. in this regard, right now, because I mean, in the context of culture wars, as in the context of any war, fronts end up being very rigid and very hard, and so that as soon as you are not fully committed, you are perceived as betraying the cause, because the cause is tenuous and the struggle is fierce, and we don't quite know how it's gonna end up. You know, I've experienced that in former Yugoslavia, where I couldn't support the kind of nationalist government. Exclusion and Embrace was written and was seen as, oh, are you sitting between chairs? You can't do that right now, even though it's an engaged text. And so my experience was, and I'm experiencing something of that in today's environment as well. You are almost expected to embrace with full force everything by both of the parties, and that I find a difficult situation in which people find themselves. And I think we've got to resist this sense that I am on the hook for everything if I choose a particular party or vote for a particular candidate. And I've tended always to think that there are a host of whole series of moral issues that concern the vision of the kind of public and common life that we ought to aspire to have together, and I have to vote not with regard to a single or a couple of issues, but that I have to vote in the light of how all these issues come together, and while realizing that no party will necessarily cover the vision, moral vision, be completely identical with the moral vision that I embrace, and so I take to heart this statement of Karl Barth that Christians are unreliable allies.
Yeah.
Allies.
Yes. Right.
But there's kind of unreliability. You can't count that I will do always what you need me to do in this particular situation. I think that you kind of have to live as a Christian in that setting, and the people with whom you collaborate, that they kind of have to count on that. Put differently, politics is not my God. Or even nation is not my God. There's a kind of ultimate seat of allegiance that might call into question subordinate allegiances.
Yeah. No, that's right. That there's an integrity at play for Christians that doesn't have as its metric sort of faithfulness to the cause or to the political party that we're unreliable allies in politics because we're hopefully pursuing faithfulness that transcends those kinds of things. I think that's right.
But at the same time, this faithfulness for the ultimate allegiance to God does not exclude kind of differentiated assessments and alignment with what, on the whole, we perceive will be more aligned with God's intentions for the world.
Yeah, and this is really key. I think in America, especially among young Christians, we're experiencing something of a resurgence of civic interest and involvement that for many, I think, originates from a sort of critique that of their parents' generation, that sort of the political priorities and the political expression that had existed was not right. I think there's encouragement to be found in that. Mm-hmm. What I am concerned about is this sort of over-identification with Christianity, with a particular political program. You know, C.S. Lewis has this essay when he's called Meditations on the Third Commandment, and he's considering the creation of a Christian political party in the UK as existed in other countries in Western Europe at the time. And he ends up generally siding against it, but more importantly, offering the warning that even if it did exist, he says the temptation when you combine faith and politics is to claim God has said when he has not spoken. Miroslav, you're pointing out this tension between this imperative we have to bring our faith to politics, but what our friend Jamie Smith refers to in his relatively new book, Awaiting the King, something that I think is exactly right. He says our politics should be tinged with a level of ambivalence. And what I think he means by that is, you know, there's an understanding that the translation work that we do from ultimate things to sort of prudential political decisions, that we're imperfect translators. And we could feel very convicted about sort of a particular policy instrument or a particular election. But we, as Christians, we just have to do our best to, I think, in general, create enough space to not conflate, for instance, the words of the gospel, you know, the truth of scripture with the same level of authority that we'd give to a political prescription. And I'm worried that I think that's always a concern when it comes to mixing faith and politics. And I hope it's something that we can guard against, because in the past, I don't think it's been guarded against effectively. And there have been repercussions to that.
Yeah, no, I like it. I like this idea with certain form, a certain level of ambivalence, holding these convictions, even advocating for convictions with a certain provisionality. Even if you want that's what this what life in this world in many regards is. And hopefully also this provisionality includes something like a willingness to learn, to be corrected, without necessarily compromising the agency that is required. And I think, I mean, one of the concerns that I have is this conflation between between Christianity and nation, so that the service to the nation becomes almost identical with the service to God, and that's deeply problematic. I mean, I'm really fond of this statement of Nietzsche's, that national God cannot be God for everybody, cannot be good God, cannot be forbearing and loving toward both friend and foe, right? So if you make God, if you make America Christian nation and align God's purposes with Americans, with your vision of Americans' purposes, you're going to have a pretty distorted vision of who God is. You're not going to have a God of unconditional love. You're going to have a fierce deity. And I think consequence of that tomorrow is going to be that a lot of people are going to be a lot of people who've been disappointed in a political project will be as well disappointed in God. And that's too bad, because I think it's going to have a further secularizing effect.
I should say that concerns me too. And I am in some ways, you know, all for aligning the nation with God's will. History suggests that even if the aim starts out that way, all too quickly, it becomes aligning God to the nation's will and the nation's interests, and that's a dangerous place to be.
I think God's going to align the world with His will, we can in a broken way participate.
That's right.
But when God is made guardian of social order, atheism becomes condition of social change. Someone said, and I think that's right.
Miroslav, I think that many people, including young people, but I think this is a widely felt sort of feeling that politics is placing too much of a burden on people's lives. You know, I've said that politics is causing spiritual harm in people's lives and in Americans' lives, and a big reason for that is that Americans are going to politics to get spiritual and emotional needs met, and politics is not fit to bear those burdens, but politicians will attempt to at least be perceived as meeting some of those needs if that's what we go to politics looking for. And there is just this tension that many Americans feel when it comes to politics. You know, this idea of political homelessness has become really common, and people identifying as politically homeless. And I think there's something sort of worthwhile there, but what I've said is that the crisis for Christians is not that we're politically homeless, but that we ever thought we could make a home in politics at all.
That's a perfect way to put it. I love that way of putting it.
Yeah. Talk about how do we deal with the tension of life, Mirza? Right. So I just think it's so important to these tensions are not unique to politics. we need to, in my view, you know, we need to identify this as a subset of discipleship questions, you know, but when it comes to politics, you know, how do folks deal with the tension as Christians without sort of, as we've discussed, sort of provoking either withdrawal or these sort of rationalizations in which people end up eventually sort of giving themselves over to the gods of politics.
I'm just wondering, I'm thinking aloud now, because it's such an important and almost viscerally felt question. And I think it's felt viscerally because people see that something really important is at stake. But on the other hand, they feel either impotent or when they get involved, it's kind of not fully them. They're not at home. They're kind of homeless.
Yes,
even in this endeavor. And I'm wondering whether that homelessness as you said, we shouldn't expect to be at home in politics. It's kind of a roll up your sleeves, and if you and do sometimes work that is very hard, that is not in its immediate, it's terribly rewarding, and you're doing it maybe with somebody who you do not necessarily agree with, but you're doing it not because you feel at home there. You do because you're trying to make this country or your town a home that is worthy of everybody's dignity. Mm. And so it seems to me like take a shovel and shovel that stuff, right?
Right.
You're going to get calluses. You're going to go. And then if you have a place to be at home, to be at one with yourself, to be at one with the community, that's a great place to be. And maybe churches can be that. Maybe families can be that. But if we think of political spaces of engagement as such, maybe we're set ourselves for disappointment, or maybe when I expect that, and sometimes I do, maybe I have to tell myself, I just need to grow up a little bit. Mm. Everything isn't home.
Yes. But, and, you know, when I think about home, you know, I think about security. Mm. And so let's maybe close with joy. And I've talked about this before, so I'll just sort of set it up and then would love to, there's a reason, you know, why I talk about this before, cause I just think it's absolutely central. I mentioned Willard before, and I do that often. Dallas Willard is someone who's been very influential in my life. And, he defines joy as a pervasive and constant sense of well-being. And Miroslav, for the last 5-6 years at my events, I've asked folks, you know, how many of you would describe our politics as being full of a pervasive and constant sense of well-being? And it's an absolute laugh line. But I think we need to ask ourselves why that is. We need to ask ourselves why it seems laughable that even in the sort of the tidal waves and the throes of politics, that Christians might be able to bring to politics a sense of joy with them that perseveres and actually provides the foundation and the background for their political engagement. That they get that pervasive and constant sense of well-being from outside of politics. And so therefore, when they engage in politics, they're not looking for that ultimate security. Do you think joy can be a resource for where sort of Christian political engagement needs to go? And what other sort of distinctly Christian resources, you know, to close are on your mind and heart right now when you think about what is available for Christians in public life?
Well, I think you earlier mentioned also hope as one of those Christian virtues, stances that we have, and I think I would put the hope and joy together. I think any form of engagement, life itself, requires hope. It requires hope, sometimes against hope, as Apostle Paul says. Even when things look that they're going all the wrong way, even when we know that tomorrow weather, political weather, is going to be bad, forecasts are such, we still have hope. How does one have that kind of a hope? A hope that is against circumstances. And I think that's a key to the Christian understanding of hope. And I think our hope is not in the certain course of events or even in our ability to control a certain course of events, but our hope is ultimately in the possibility of something new because God is present and God is active in the world. And to me, that's tied to the question of joy. You're right that it's very difficult, certainly in political engagements, but in generally in our lives, to have this kind of sustained joy. What I find that people often have hard time rejoicing even in a kind of particular things and stay for a while in joy. And one of the reasons for it is that we're terribly perfectionist society. Modernity is perfectionism, one way to express it. But for perfectionists can never rejoice, right?
Right, 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 right.
Because joy says, ah, this is great. This is good enough, right? And I can breathe and I can dance. Wow, something incredible has happened, right? It's great. It's very good. That's when some great joy happens. But when ordinary joys happen, ah, fantastic. I can stay with it, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's this sense of both appreciating what is and rejoicing in it, and then hoping for the impossible. And holding this tension between joy and hope, or letting two inform each other, one which is about the goodness of present and the other one which is about goodness of the future. I think if we have these two virtues, it's gonna propel us, and it's going to free us from fear, and we'll be active on behalf of the good that God is doing in the world.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's a wonderful place to end. Miroslav, can't thank you enough for this conversation. That really, speaking of joy, it's been a joy talking with you. And thank you for your work, and excited to share this with folks.
Thank you very much also for your work, for the years of work that you've done and that you continue to do. You've been so great in the forefront of political activism and presence and thinking through the issue. So thank you.
That means a lot. Thanks.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation. What an inspiring man he is. And so grateful for this partnership with the Yale Center for Faith and Culture, with Miroslav's podcast, For the Life of the World. Just a real joy to be able to do that. I'd also like to give a shout out to Evan Rosa, who works for the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. Evan's been a longtime friend. He is really the person who made this happen. And so shout out to you, Evan. All right. By the time this runs, we'll just be over 2 weeks from the election. Like I said in the intro to this episode, we're going to do more episodes before the election. You'll be prepared. You'll be ready to go. But I hope this conversation put you in a good frame of mind for what we're all about to encounter over the next couple of weeks. Hey, this is Michael Ware. You've been listening to the Faith 2020 podcast. Thanks for joining.